Today's episode is brought to you by Diabolik DVD.
Featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolik DVD. Right now on Diabolik, we have new from AGFA. They have Blood Lake, Ninja Zombie, Lady Street Fighter, and lots more. We had a fun chat with them recently. They have all their new titles from Vinegar Syndrome, including Play Dead, Hellmaster, and Night Owl. And from Blue Underground, they have the all-new 4K restoration of the New York Ripper as a three-disc limited edition featuring a lenticular slipcover. Lenticular. I need a shower. Okay. So for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com or find them on Facebook.
Okay, and welcome to episode 155 of Shockwaves. I'm your host, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Mr. Hateproof.
I am.
Elric Kane.
I'm Hateproof, and I feel like this is a bit of a killer POV throwback reunion.
Let me introduce Becca first, and then
you'll
we'll
see
go.
The whole
Wait,
reason.
What? I'm here.
I'm going in
you're
order.
You slow down.
You're part of the Becca's reason.
I'm aware I was on killer POV.
Yeah, do I need to mansplain that you were on killer POV?
The three of us were on killer POV since Ryan is off making
That's
movies,
right. uh-huh.
and we have a special guest in the room.
Hi, I am not Ryan Turek.
You are not Ryan Turek.
No, let's play it off like you are.
You sound equally masculine to me.
I am very masculine.
Yeah, that's good.
We have Aaron Dries with us, who is on episode 100 of Killer POV, our live one from
Texas Frightmare. Which was the first time we met you, and we were so excited to meet you that we put you on the damn show.
But we literally pulled you in, right?
Yes.
How much warning did you have?
None.
None. We pulled,
None whatsoever.
We were standing up doing it live, and we'll get it live. And then we were like, let's get Aaron.
Did I give you my t-shirt?
That was it.
No. There was no exchanges of any kind.
Did you guys swap outfits?
Yeah, I thought we did.
No, we were both wearing blazers. You were like, hey, you're wearing a blazer. Yay, team blazer. What are you doing right now?
I do that to all Australians. I like to put you on the spot. But yeah, he's not a guest. He's just hanging out in the
I'm hanging.
He's here.
He came for the pie.
Yeah, I came for the pie. There was some really great rhubarb pie that was just served up to us.
Yes. I made pie.
But you are in the States. So people that don't know, you are an author. You've written several books at this point.
Yep. The Fallen Boys is amazing.
Oh, thank you. That's very sweet.
You are so welcome. I have my own copy because it's got bugs in it.
Well,
so you're in town you've been traveling for a couple of book conventions?
Conventions, but all on the East Coast. And I figured I've got a week in between, might as well come and just hang out with people. So I've been stalking. I've just been loitering out the front of Blumhouse.
He was outside with like giant bags and he literally looked like a bag guy. And I was like, you want to come into Blumhouse?
And he's like, oh. I'm belligerent at best.
But we're glad to have you.
I'll definitely take your clothes.
Yeah,
I'll definitely take your clothes.
We hung out together at Camp Fangoria this weekend, which was just awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
Pretty much the only horror movies I got to watch.
Actually, I'm the same. That's why I wanted him on to cover for us.
You guys just go step out. I'm just going to go solo.
When there's an Australian here, your New Zealand accent comes out a lot more. So pay attention, folks.
I'm an enabler at the best of times. So come on.
Favorite Australian horror film?
Ooh.
Because I don't think I've ever asked that.
Favorite Australian
horror film?
Road Games.
Yeah, nice. Good answer.
Road Games.
Especially after last week.
Have you seen Alison's Birthday?
No.
Okay, that's an Australian horror film that I ask a lot of people about.
So which one? And I haven't seen it, but I tried to see it a couple weeks ago and it's not on Shudder. I was like, oh, I thought it would be.
I have it on VHS. So it is
from
awesome.
From the 80s.
Is there a VHS player here at Blumhouse?
We're going to find one.
Ryan's office?
Yeah, it could be.
All right, okay, cool. Awesome. Yeah, but no, Road Games all the way. Franklin. My man.
Nice.
Everett DeRoche wrote that, I'm pretty certain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he's a great, great writer. Yeah. Sadly missed. Gone before his time.
Well, what about, tell us about some of the fiction that you're reading these days since you've been hitting up and traveling a lot. Because I know you crossed paths with our mutual friend, Paul Tremblay.
Yes, I'm basically.
Who just got another wonderful endorsement from Stephen King.
Yes,
oh my God.
I
just ordered his book, Growing Things.
I haven't read it
yet. I cannot wait for it to arrive.
I'm going to be picking myself up a copy of Growing Things. I'm going to be hanging with Paul Tremblay and others in about when I get off this red eye later on, straight after the show, basically. And so, I love Paul Tremblay. I recently read The Cabin at the End of the World, which is fantastic that he wrote. That is just a really strong book.
Intense.
Really intense. And I'm currently reading a really great book called October, which is by a Canadian author named Michael Rowe. And it's a like a queer witch story about like this bullied teenager who finds solace and comfort in a coven of witches that are kind of loitering around, as I was loitering out the front of the warm house.
Word of the night is loitering.
Loitering, yeah. Wow. It's also on the majority of the police records that are associated with me as well. So, it it's fantastic. I'm about halfway through that and I'm absolutely loving it. And that's in my backpack just over there.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm always reading something.
Prove it.
I will happily unzip my bag for you.
Wow, that's got hot quick.
I know.
You can unzip his bag. All right. Well, let's talk about Camp Fango.
Yeah.
So it's Fango at 40 today, which was made abundantly clear by millions of photos.
What a cool little gimmick.
That was really fun.
I'm sure it'll still be happening by the time this episode
ends. I didn't know it was a gimmick. I assumed because the first one I saw was Becca, so I just assumed it was something they were doing related to her and the fact that she used to be at Fangoria and still are with your show. And then your one popped up. I go, okay, it's just people in Fangoria. And then I went on Twitter and realized this was actually a thing you could do and an app. And that's where I was like, I got to get bad taste on there.
On Twitter, Fangoria's Twitter basically posted, it's for their 40th anniversary. It's basically a cover to Fangoria with like a little question mark on the cover saying, hey, tweet us your photo and we will put you on the cover and reply tweet to it. So you actually won, Elric, because you sent them your photo of you as Derek from Bad Taste.
Yes, he'll represent.
It was good.
Yeah. And they immediately
made me Leatherface 3. Did you see that? I think probably because I had the chainsaw. They probably didn't have a handy Bad Taste.
Yeah. That was pretty wonderful.
Okay.
It was just fun to see everybody we know.
It was pretty cool.
Do it.
Yeah.
It's great. And also, it's I guess because we are almost all the exact age of that.
Yeah.
Because I've always been, you know, it's within a year and that always means something. So it's just cool to see it still going
through our whole lives.
Yeah, it's been crazy forever. So, but we were lucky, and that's why I posted the photo today, because I remembered how funny it was when we all dressed as Blair Witch.
Oh, yeah.
And my God.
I thought it'd be funny to remind people, like, why'd you give us the job of camp counselors when we can't even, you know, follow a map?
Well, that's because, you know what it was? That was one of the Blumhouse Halloween parties. Yeah. But the year before, the three of us went, and we were completely different costumes.
That's right.
I think I was dressed as a Care Bear.
Yeah, so we were just like odd things, and we were like, you know what? Next year we got to coordinate.
We should every year it should be a group costume.
When we were like went off to get a drink, like nobody knew. They had to see the three of us together and be like, oh yeah, that's
right. We're pretty lucky we have a redhead. It's like perfect for that story. But you know,
next year you're all going to go as Care Bears, right?
Right, sure.
Oh.
Becca, you are on brand.
I am so Cheer Bear. I was Cheer Bear that year. Actually,
I mean, I was pushing hard for Human Centipede. But Rob was not into it.
I'm not.
I don't want to crawl around the parking lot.
I know. But
that's too complicated.
But we were camp counselors. We did have shortest shorts. I need my shorts back.
Oh, shit. I forgot about that.
I was swapping outfits. And by the way, I need my sports bra and my Josh shirt back.
I'm wearing that.
I don't actually like have a pair of shorts. I don't know if I've ever worn shorts since I was a kid.
I've ever seen your legs before. That was an exciting night.
Aaron got a little fresh there. So Elric happened to bring two pairs of shorts. Yeah. So I borrowed one and basically everyone's like, why were you hiding these legs from us? I'm like, oh, far too kind.
But Elric was wearing like shorty shorts.
Well, I couldn't find
not as short as mine.
I couldn't find short shorts, but they were lime green, so that was gross enough.
And you had the matching bandana.
It was fun. I don't know how we got that gig. I don't know who entrusted us to be the camp counselor.
We have an in.
We all have Fangoria cred.
But it was a fun thing to do in the end. Like, we really didn't know exactly what we were going to be doing when we got up there, but it was super fun. Just we kind of provided the
some of us did some of us read the email.
I read the email. I just was like, you can never expect what's
going to
happen.
Well, you know what it is? It was a fun. So here's the thing. We're in Los Angeles. There's a lot of events that happen around town pretty regularly, and including double features and movies and things like that. And in fact, there were competing events that night because there's just always something to do. But what I liked about this was basically they were trying to do something celebratory, like with Fangoria. So it wasn't just about the movies, because we got The Burning, Sleepaway Camp, and Evil Dead 2. They really tried to build this whole fun camp atmosphere. They had guests. They had, you know, Mick Garris was doing his thing. You know, music. They had an umami burger and a bar set up and the whole deal. And
a really cool rooftop.
It was on the rooftop, and, you know, basically you could hear the film, but you have these headphones to like fully hear the Dalek. I thought that was kind of fun.
As I called it, looking out, when it got dark, it got real creepy. I called it a cyborg Scientology.
Yeah, because you could stare into the there. Scientology building trying to see if the Sea Orgs were still up.
No, because like when we started, it was the camp thing. But like in the middle, like right in the middle of the night, when I looked out, all I could see is the glowing of the headphones. Couldn't see faces anymore. And it was super creepy.
Can you imagine what we all looked like from the adjoining building? Look at that Tron convention over there.
We were right next to the Scientology building. Yeah, it was like the Scientology High Tower, which there were people up at like 2 a.m. there.
Yeah, they're all watching.
Imagine living in one of those neighbor buildings.
You just watch the movie.
You're forgetting about the most important thing, which were those incredibly lethal pina coladas that they were serving at the bar. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. But it actually was fun. Like, that's the kind of thing that could be really silly, but I actually think it was actually legitimately fun.
It was great.
Like, I think the vibe people were having was a really cool vibe, and so hopefully they'll do something like that again.
There were lots of little details, and I think they were paying off massively. It was lots of fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, good
movies. We did trivia, which was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Gave out tons of prizes.
Did her haikus?
I did. No one got them. Aaron, like, loved them.
I was sitting there writhing in my chair because I knew the answer to all of them, but none of them tickled me quite so much as "You're My Soul to Take."
That was
I was bursting. I've never been so envious.
Yeah, no one got that one. We gave good clues and no one got "My Soul to Take."
Yeah, I'm here for all your "My Soul to Take" trivia, by all means.
I'll work some more in.
Condor.
But the one
California
I was...
Condor.
Yeah, let's talk about the films because you had not seen The Burning
I hadn't seen
while.
The Burning in a long time, and I was super excited to see it again, even though I've always liked it. I have a couple key images burned into my brain, obviously, from that movie, but I didn't really remember any of the drama or the setup besides it being a cropsy thing. I was sitting next to between Becca and Aaron here, and me and Aaron multiple times turned to each other, especially in the second half of that movie, and just kept kind of marveling at the form of the film at times and the decisions. And it's especially having that we're watching a lot of the Jason films at the moment, or I'm just starting to rewatch them.
I got six this week.
Six, this is much more realistic. The situation and the way that young people react to each death is actually almost completely accurate to how I imagine, and besides just going straight to the cops. Whereas in Friday, it's all about no one knowing what's happening as long as possible, so you don't have to deal with that reality. But you see it on the exhaustion on their faces. You see it in the tension. And I was actually quite impressed by that. I think the actual, you know, big horror sequences are really good. I think there's some like really great gore gags. And it, you know, it actually gets really intense in the second half. But we couldn't help not knowing it was Weinstein's first movie. It was hard, and we both noted it.
It's like a confessional.
Yeah.
Down to the greasy penis POV shot.
There's so much forced groping. Yeah.
Especially in that first half. Yeah. And it's in a way that it's the guys. Like,
and talking about it, like even when they're not groping, they're talking about groping.
But the weird thing is the film doesn't look like it's saying that's okay. And that's the weird part. The film's just showing them as kind of creepy, but it's weird. It's like the
context
behavior.
Context is a powerful thing.
Oh, yeah.
And then the fact that the killer is like got giant,
Shears.
Shears. And Harvey Weinstein's nickname is, you know, Harvey Scissorhands. So my brain's going, oh, it's really? Just like, yeah. Because he cut everyone's movies up in the editing room. So I kept thinking, oh, he's Harvey Scissorhands. I'm like, oh, this is kind of
And ironically, the one movie they never remade was their own.
I think it's really good. I think somebody could remake this movie. Yeah. I think Cropsey's a great killer. And just the way they made this version of that myth look, you could push that even further. It's funny because it has a faux ending before the real ending. And when the faux ending happened, I was so disappointed because I thought, oh, that was way too easy. I was actually really disappointed going, oh, it was so good up until that. And then you get one more burst. I was like, okay, good. I'm good.
It's got such a great last shot as well. That little last moment, it just ends on such a nice little... Yeah.
It really went up a whole star for me.
It didn't fall into a lot of kind of the slash and hack or hack and slash formula, like tropes that you have that we'd start seeing by this time. Like there was still kind of a little bit of the element of the kids sneak off to have sex.
Yeah.
But it wasn't so much group of kids and he picks them off one by one as much as he kind of followed them on their journey. Because a large chunk of it was them going on this boat trip and then camping and him kind of like following along with it. Kind of picking off the stragglers, it functioned differently and it felt different. And the reactions felt different, I have to say.
Yeah. Like,
and
it also, felt the pacing as well is really interesting. The first half of that film is just building, you know, it also has a really weird structure in that it starts off in the city and then it kind of shifts and transitions.
We did talk about that,
And then it transitions, you know, to the camp setting and then it builds and builds and builds for quite and then it explodes in this really kind of euphorically gory moment. Tom Savini definitely showed up to work that day.
Yeah.
And it's circular.
Yeah.
I still don't understand the city scene when I think about it because it wasn't needed.
No, not at all.
It just
shows
a little
shade of them. I think they just wanted to get a kill in kind of early.
Yeah.
Structurally, like just an obscure random kill because it opens basically with the what happened, the back, you know, the campfire tale. And then nothing for a while. You just have to kind of sit with these kids for a while before anything actually happens. Right. But
Cropsy gets to go to town too. Yeah, yes. Groceries. Yeah. You know, yeah. He's just all wandering around, you know, with a brown paper bag under his arm. Hey, that's just me chilling.
Well, and it's always fun to see these casts because, of course, Jason Alexander from Seinfeld, who is supposed to be young.
Pretty handsome, isn't
it? Has hair.
Yeah,
he has full head of hair.
He's definitely supposed to be like the smart ass of it.
Yeah.
And he is.
Yeah.
He makes a lot of penis jokes.
He does make a lot of penis jokes.
Fisher Stevens looks like he's 12.
So, he looks so young.
He looks so young.
And Holly Hunter, you don't see her much, but that's her first
one. She just kind of glides through it. But Jason Alexander is worth a note. He's looking good. You know, it's that hot minute that where he existed as an attractive strapping lad.
I bet George has his fans.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I bet some people, that's their type.
There are people listening right now who are like, yes, I feel validated. Finally, I get my George Alexander.
Send us your porn.
Costanza fetish.
Wow.
So that, I think that played like gangbusters. And then I can't remember what we did. I think there was some break. There was
we
some
did trivia.
Yeah, that's right.
Was it trivia?
We were the entertainment.
We were the entertainment. So you can imagine how that went.
You were disassociated.
Elric had one too many of those strong pina coladas.
I did have a couple of them. They were good. I had those high socks. So something had to keep me afloat.
Right.
But then we did. I was about to say Slumber Party Massacre, which would have been pretty good.
Sleepaway camp.
Yeah. I'm still drunk.
Tiffany Shevis introduced it, and then there was a video intro from Phyllis Rose. Mm-hmm. And then we got to see that again, which is also kind of an awkward movie every couple of years.
Yeah.
But I kind of love it because there's just nothing else like it.
Yeah.
Even among all the slasher movies, there's just those Long Island kids with the accents.
And they're real kids. They have a lot of real kids.
Yeah.
That was true, that Sleepaway Camp was one of the only slashers that actually had kids instead of adults playing teens who are counselors. It actually had 10-year-olds at camp, playing 10-year-olds at camp. And so it functions a little bit differently and it almost feels a little bit more intense because it is these kids there, not 18-year-olds.
Which feels grosser when the old guy's trying to pick up the girls and you're what is going on?
Like when he's picking her up and shaking her, I was like, ugh.
But I kept thinking about was when the last scene came, I'm just looking out at all the neighbors going, if you just went to your window in this moment and you get to see the end of Sleepaway Camp, it would be the greatest shock. You'd be what are they doing?
Sleepaway Camp is a big favorite of the Scientology crowd.
Honey, let's just open up the windows and have some night. Wow. Oh, my God.
I suspect it's the secret most of them are hiding and why they are at Scientology.
That's right.
Just to
guess. So much Scientology bashing. So we are hate-proof, Elric.
That's
hate-proof.
Okay.
I might have to amend my hate-proof.
Got it.
Actually, I don't hate Scientology. That's their choice.
It's a choice.
What's that one from Fast Times at Ridgemont High where he's looking, he's pointing at the sign. He's like, live it. Learn it.
Oh, really? I don't remember.
You have to do that with your hate-proof shit. Come on.
Well, hate-proof is related because it is the son of Mad Men.
Oh, yeah. Jonathan Ellis.
Which was made around the same time.
Yeah, as The Burning.
Yeah. So if you're not aware, hate-proof is not just a t-shirt, it's a concept, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's got merchandise that says it on it, but basically, no, it's just, these are troubled times right now, obviously, and it's really hard not to get upset or angry or scared or... with everything going on. And it's just kind of a way of the idea is let's rise above it and just be hate-proof, literally. Mm-hmm. It gets harder and harder every day. Yeah.
They did not pay for that commercial, but it's a good thing. So, and then we all stayed for Evil Dead 2 till the very end. And that was amazing seeing it again, especially the ending. With the thing with the book, it was definitely an N-word. Anyway, no, we didn't stay for any of it.
Yeah, we made it till the start of Evil Dead 2, which about that time, it was about 2:30 or so.
It was early.
That's when I was definitely I was tired.
You're feeling it at 12, so then it kept going.
Yeah, and then I had a soda and I was all better. But I was definitely feeling it by 2:30.
The bummer is I really actually wanted to watch Evil Dead 2 again. I just didn't want to be awake.
The I got excited about it. It did start to get exciting. Yeah. You're like, oh man,
seeing it on the screen.
I love it. Yeah. It's kind of fun.
And there were people in the audience who hadn't seen it before, which is kind of, it's a great feeling when you're watching movies, even in a big crowd like that.
Yeah.
There was four people up the back who have never seen that film before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to sit next to them and just watch them.
Yeah. We asked before every movie if you'd seen it. And there was a good handful of people that hadn't seen any of them. So that was kind of a fun way to see it.
We also added a special guest to our episode that is live tomorrow. Live in person Midsummer Scream.
We're going to be at Midsummer Scream,
Doing our Haunted House episode, and we live in the moment added a guest to our show.
Yes, Axel Carolyn will be joining us. We are in, I think it's the screaming room. No, wait, we're in one of the rooms from 1 to 2 on Saturday. And then
I thought it was later, 2:30. I got an email today saying 2:30.
Oh, we're sometime Saturday afternoon. It may have been bumped, but we're sometime Saturday afternoon. And then on Sunday, I'm doing a live Nightmare University on the history of Hellraiser, and Ashley Lawrence is joining me for the second half, and is Sunday evening. I think it's like 5 o'clock. And then I'm also in a fashion show, so that's kind of fun.
Yeah, no, me and Rob are too.
You're going to join?
No, are you
doing it?
Yeah,
she makes box.
We're always in a fashion show.
She makes underwear. It's pretty cool. Oh,
show off your legs, Rob.
That's definitely not us then. I'm out. Hard out.
Yeah, no, I just looked it up. Our panel at Midsummer is Saturday at 2:45 p.m. on August 3rd.
Yeah, and Axel, you know, has been on the show before, of course, but she has a great book on, is it Haunting Films or Ghost Stories? Yeah, Ghost Films.
Ghost,
yeah.
Like Supernatural.
Ghost Films. Yeah.
Makes total sense that she'll be on that episode.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
By the way, you should also listen. I was on the way here, I was listening to the latest episode of Best Movies Never Made. Oh, yeah. Steve Scarlett and Josh Miller's episode with
me,
Becca McKendry.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
Talking Lovecraft at the Mountains of Madness.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Del Toro, Tom Cruise thing.
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about Lovecraft in the first half. And
excellent.
What a crummy racist guy he was.
Yeah, he's a real shitty individual who was a really good writer. Yeah. Yeah, just across the board, like, there was very few groups he didn't hate, including one that his wife was a part of.
Yes.
It just, like,
I didn't know all the history, but also Jesse Merlin's on, so here, and he's like a Lovecraft expert, so hearing his booming voice, he should just do audiobooks.
I know, right?
Because they have him reading parts of the script, and as soon as he's like, his voice is just so cool,
and it's like they have us reading against each other, so it's like me going, I think we should go up the mountain, and then it goes to him, and it's just like this beautiful Shakespearean just booming voice of it reading Lovecraft. It's
you have a great booming amazing. Voice too.
It's booming, but it's shrill. I'll go shrill.
No, he does have a pretty amazing.
But thank you for that. No, I reading the whole script and everything and seeing kind of like what it could have been and then understanding why it could never be that. It was a lot of fun.
After having done all that research, I haven't listened to that one yet. I didn't even know it was up, but I would. That's the kind of topic I'm very interested in. But do you feel, knowing all that now with his new cachet that he didn't have back then, Guillermo could get that made now? Still couldn't make it. Okay.
Well, you know what? His other thing that he admitted after the fact, and I haven't finished the episode, but he was so adamant about being a rated R movie.
That's the biggest
at the
thing.
Time. But he said after the fact that he regretted it and said he should have done a theatrical cut at PG-13 and then just released a director's cut on home video anyway.
Yeah. That was the biggest thing holding the movie back, because it's the same thing that like the Crimson Peak scenario, that when you are making like $850 million horror movie, you know, Marvel-sized horror movie, it has to be something that every single person across America is going to want to go see. And not even just that every single person in China and, you know, every other continent is going to want to go see. So if it isn't a really vanilla PG-13 thing that can be sold globally, then it literally is just kind of throwing money down a hole. And
was it Tom Cruise the idea?
Tom Cruise was the idea, which is, I mean, that's
that
a sellable commodity.
Yeah, yeah.
That would have helped. But at the same time, when the whole thing is just, I mean, it's intense. And it's not like, you know, there's not like crazy sex or anything like that, but there was definitely nudity and a lot of insanity and animals leaking and people killing each other. And he wanted it to be really Lovecrafty and visceral. But at the same time, he wants you to actually see the cities that the elders built and see the elders and the demented looking penguins and the elder gods and everything.
I have vivid memories of like tentacle penguins.
Yeah, they're
you
know, kind of.
Why wouldn't you lead the pitch?
They're
oozy
albino penguins.
Yeah, albino tentacle penguins.
Interesting.
Also, a band we're about to form.
You can come anytime.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, I don't know. Crimson Peak was an interesting point because I didn't realize that. I forgot it was rated R, and it really didn't need to be. Yeah. I remember that was my biggest problem with it. Is there was like two moments that drove it to R that were totally unnecessary. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it now, and the production budget was $55 million.
I would have put it more than that.
And it made domestic total gross is $31 million.
Yeah.
And worldwide is $74, which, you know, that's $74 million is a lot of money. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. But when you spent $55 to make it.
Well, and the marketing on top of that's probably another $40. So
that's a lot of money.
Not making money at that point. Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of the biggest thing is that when you do have these kind of, you know, we're just going to throw money at the screen, which is what Del Toro wanted for this. And the fact that you're literally going to have to shoot it in something that looks like Antarctica.
Yeah.
It's not going to be pleasant shooting conditions, and it's obviously going to have to either be an elaborate set or you're going to have to travel and take everyone with you to remote conditions. this is a very expensive project. And so to make it something that is not accessible globally is insanity. Mm. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, and I don't trust Tom Cruise with horror. I love Cruise. I'll watch him in anything. I literally just discovered these Jack Reacher movies, which are great.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the first one's great. I haven't done about
the
second.
He's great in all these movies, but The Mummy is just such a misstep. And it's like, no,
it does not work at all.
Stay to that other stuff that you're great at.
When it was first coming out that he was going to be involved in this, he had just done Live, Die, Repeat. Uh-huh. And I was like, which okay, well, fuck I like yes, that. I enjoy this movie. But after The Mummy, I'm like, no, go away. Yeah. So,
but definitely, The Mummy's tough because the tone of him, even they get wrong. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. They give him the wrong kind of character. He's basically playing like Brendan Fraser, dumb.
But it's like the wrong kind of movie.
Not, but also, it's not how you want to watch Tom Cruise. Like, that's the thing about managing your star appeal is he's been so good at that over his career. That's actually the biggest misstep I've ever seen of the kind of role they gave someone. Because if he just played Tom Cruise, that movie might have even worked.
It might have worked.
He might have been good enough to elevate it, but man, it really just, I don't believe him as a dumb person. I just don't buy it when he's playing dumb.
Well, maybe we can pitch Del Toro on, what about Brendan Fraser in the Mountains of Madness?
Bring back the Fraser.
#BringBackTheFraser.
Who would be good in that role? I don't know.
Yeah, I can't think of anyone.
Jason Statham can do anything.
That's true.
Oh, you and your Meg fantasies.
Oh my God. Yeah. I want the Meg Mountain of Madness crossover.
Meg. Yeah, I can't.
It's Cthulhu. Jason Statham versus Cthulhu. Come on, guys.
If it's Crank Cthulhu, I am in.
Right?
If it's Crank versus Cthulhu, you wouldn't watch that.
That's kind
of
cool.
Cthulhu was not in the script at the Mountains of Madness because the focus is much more on the actual city and things like that. So Cthulhu rises at the very end very, very quickly. And it's kind of just as a shadow. It's not so much like giant. He doesn't appear like a kaiju and, walk around.
But it's in Statham's rider that says Cthulhu must appear.
Cthulhu must
appear. If I'm in this movie, Cthulhu's in this movie.
I get a throwing star and it's going to be badass.
Can he not play Cthulhu? Statham can do anything.
Interesting.
Let's have ambition, guys. This is Del Toro we're talking about.
I like it.
It's so funny. I was driving around with Aaron last night and randomly, Ghosts of Mars somehow came up. And I was like, would you like to hear the track Pam Grier's Head from Ghosts of Mars? And you were like, what's that? And I put it on. I was like, this is when Statham's like, I think we got a problem here.
Oh, yeah.
And for the record, it was so good we played it twice.
Twice, yeah. I was like, this is the Jason Statham scene where he's like freaking out. He's like, I think we got a problem here.
I don't remember Pam Grier's Head on a stick, but I do remember Clea DuVall's, untimely end. There is a statute of limitation on Ghost of Mars. Spoilers, right?
The day it came out.
I think we passed Ghost of Mars.
If you didn't see it by now, you're not a real Carpenter fan.
Go back and watch The Ward.
Hey, guys. This week, I watched a brand new show on Netflix called The Typewriter, or just Typewriter. Did anybody else watch it?
No, and tell me about this, because I've seen people, I didn't even hear about it.
Me
just
neither.
Kind of dropped.
I've never heard of
it.
I've heard
people mention it. So what's this?
Didn't you watch it, Elric? I texted Elric and was like, go watch it.
Okay, I was having this problem, which happens every once in a while when you do all these shows. I just couldn't find a movie to watch. I'm sitting there going from movie to movie, and I was half committing to something and didn't care about any of it. And then she goes, I heard The Typewriter is scariest thing ever. Or somebody tweeted that.
It was on CNN.
Oh, on CNN. And so I was like, all right, I'll check it out. So I think I watched around the same time as you. I watched the first two.
First episode, and I will probably go back and continue. Yeah. So my mom sends me, she'll forward me news articles anytime horror is even remotely mentioned on major news networks. And so she forwarded me one from CNN that says, because of the show The Typewriter on Netflix, humanity can no longer sleep. And I was like, okay, whatever, I'm in. And so I watched it. It is an Indian TV show.
Doesn't it feel a little bit like India's Mike Flanagan's Haunting of Hill
House? It does, but with a Stranger Things vibe.
Yeah.
And as I was watching it, because I've watched a lot of Bollywood horror movies, it is the least kind of Indian production, I think.
No, it feels very Western.
It feels very Western.
Yeah. And the accents have clearly been dubbed to be Western, but dubbed well with Indian voices.
It's good dubbing. Yeah. The dubbing did not piss me off as much as a lot of shows do when they dub like that. But even just kind of the presentational, it feels very Western in plot, in structure, in how it's being portrayed and everything like that. Even in the horror, having watched a lot of Indian horror films, it does not feel, the horror feels more Western. It's being compared a lot to Stranger Things, but I've heard that that's only in the first episode. Mm. So it starts in a big giant mansion where we find out that the mansion is haunted and this writer lived there and he used to write about all the ghosts, but then this is all the cold open. We learn that a ghost has killed him and everybody moved out. And now we are here decades later. His granddaughter is now all grown up with kids of her own, and she is moving the entire family back into the mansion. And we're volleying between that storyline and a group of like 10-year-olds in town, which is where people are calling it Stranger Things, who have this ghost hunting club and are obsessed with the house because they think that there's ghosts inside. And so we're kind of going back and forth between the two. And then as soon as they get into the mansion, creepy stuff starts happening, and we learn the backstory of the mansion through the kids going on. What was the second episode like?
It's good. I mean, so it never becomes a kid's show. It's definitely an adult show with kids. It must be a choice, because there was a direction when I the first episode, I thought it was going to go that way. I have a feeling it's going to get really good. It went to a much darker place where something is in the house, some past spirit who a group of people want to rise up. So that was not what I was necessarily expecting from. Yeah. And so I don't know if it's the devil or a form of the devil or something, but that person is like a doppelgangering for the woman who, you know, has moved her family back in. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you're not sure who is who. So it has some pretty creepy stuff. I felt, you know, when we first spoke about it afterwards, I felt like it felt a second behind the jump scare a little bit in the first one.
Yep.
You see them all coming because you've seen a lot of movies that do it. But at least it's an original setting. And I just have a feeling maybe it's going to go to somewhere unexpected by the end.
But I did enjoy that it kept that kind of angle going. And I'll go ahead and say it because it's revealed in the very first mm-hmm. episode that when you see the ghosts, they often appear as you.
Yeah.
And so it'd be like, I see a haunting, but the haunting looks just like me and is walking around the house. And yeah. It's like an evil version of myself walking around. It's a cool angle.
Yeah.
And yeah, the jump scare is just a second behind when they try to do it in the cold open. But then the one at the end of the first episode where they did something similar, I loved. I was like, okay, that was cool.
Yeah. And then the typewriter refers to an old typewriter that the previous grandfather, the owner of the house, was a horror writer.
Yeah, he was a horror writer.
Yeah, and he was old, and it was clear that he was hiding something from his family, some dark secret. And then the typewriter now, at one point, it can say, you know, ghosts are real. The mm-hmm. typewriter types itself. So it's very intriguing. I can't tell. I'll definitely finish because they're only 50 minutes. I think there's only five episodes, so I got three more, and we'll see. But I was intrigued. It was a good find.
I did sleep that night.
Yeah,
so
the whole universe has not stopped sleeping.
But I do love that. An Indian horror miniseries comes to Netflix and CNN does an article on it.
Yeah.
That is pretty badass when we get kind of global horror expansion covered under a major news network.
It's awesome. It's also fascinating when we've just never heard of it. Like it just pops up.
Well, it was like Ghoul was a Blumhouse production.
Oh, yeah.
And even still, it just popped up one day. And I fucking loved Ghoul.
Good. One of my favorite horror films this year was from India, was that one. And I can't remember if it was Penumbra or how it was said. I'll have to look it up for our end of the year list. But it was that one about the, you know, the gold and the bottom of the house. And it just totally surprised me. Like, it was one of those movies where I still am thinking about imagery from that, because that has quite a Lovecraftian angle to it as well. And seeing that through the guise of an Indian production is just different. Which is pretty cool. So maybe there's a market there now for horror, which is cool.
Oh, there definitely is. Like, they've been doing, I remember, I don't know how it's pronounced, Boot, B-H-O-O-T, was like, it's been around for decades, but that was like, it's like a classic horror film there. Like, it's a whole separate industry. So every couple of years I'll find a couple that have come out that like will never make their way
that
over here for
some
reason.
Don't break into song. Because a lot of, even horror films sometimes would break into having
they
a
do.
Dance piece.
Yeah. No, but most of their horror does not, or if it does, the music will be worked in different ways. Like, some of the ones that I've seen, they actually still do have the music, but it's not like a, now we're going to sing and it gets really colorful and happy.
Yeah,
it'll just be like a song that one of the characters sings. So
even the one I mentioned actually does have a song, but they use it in a way that's still grounded.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like it's taking you out of reality. Yeah. It'll be like a karaoke thing or they'll sing something, but it's still like a diegetic existence within the world that we know. Indian horror.
Nice.
Cool. That was Typewriter. So kind of horror adjacent. It's not really a genre movie, but it's something really, really cool that a lot of people are talking about. And it was requested on our Shockwaves group. Checking out a new show on Amazon called The Boys.
Mm. I read the comic.
Love the comic. Yeah. It's written by Garth Ennis, who's one of my favorite comic book writers ever. He created Preacher. He actually single-handedly got me back into comics around 2000 because he took over The Punisher and did by far the most over-the-top, hilarious, just incredible version of The Punisher. It's still my favorite. Basically, Punisher Warzone, the Lexi Alexander movie, is the Garth Ennis version of Punisher. So thoroughly entertaining. And it's just he's got this knack for writing, for taking comic book cliches. You know, again, something that Alan Moore was a genius at, just taking the comic book cliches and doing them, flipping them on their head. And so this is basically, The Boys is basically about a group called the Seven, which is, quite frankly, it's just the Justice League. I mean, there's a Superman, there's a Batman, there's versions of all of them. But they are so famous, they're such a multi-billion dollar industry, that they're, as you find out, they're the most corrupt and horrible. Like, everything you could think about having superpowers, they take advantage of 100% and are just the most awful human beings on the planet. And it all gets covered up because it's, again, a multi-trillion dollar industry. The government sends them out to do their dirty work, including killing people that they might not agree with. They didn't get away with contracts. And you see the story through the eyes of two people. One is Starlight, who's the new girl that's joining, and immediately the Deep, aka their Aquaman, forces her to do something inappropriate to be part of the team. And you're just like, holy shit, this is fucking dark. Huey, is that his name? Huey, yeah, the lead guy. Because he...
Is that Carl Urban?
No. Carl Urban is the Butcher. The other main guy is kind of this awkward, nerdy guy who's got a girlfriend. And basically, it's in the opening, A-Train, who is basically their Flash, is high on something and he runs through her while he's holding her. Like, literally, she bursts into, like, just pieces, and all that's left are her hands and his hands.
Oh, Jesus.
Whoa. And they immediately cover it up. And so he's like, fuck, like, a superhero can literally just be high on drugs and kill your girlfriend and nobody can do anything about it. And then, what's his name? Carl Urban shows
Judge
up.
Judge Dredd,
who, that's very appropriate in this, who basically is like, you know what? We're the boys. We're the guys that... give them a kick in the ass when they need it because they think they can't be touched. And so that's kind of the idea, is they form a group that kind of takes out the Supes in a pretty fun and horrible way. But it's just, it's great, over the top fun. It's a very adult version of, say, something like Justice League that's gory as hell. There's just a lot of, I mean, again, it's like, if you like Punisher Warzone, it's like kind of that tone, but definitely more serious. There is one, I'm about four episodes in or five episodes in, and there is a bit that actually, like, really disturbed me, mild spoiler, basically, like, the Superman character, goes onto a plane that's been hijacked, and accidentally, kills the terrorist after he kills the pilot. And so nobody can, you know, land the plane. And he makes the decision, well, then I guess I'm out of here. And it's like a whole plane full of people begging him.
Wait, but the old Superman could have...
And I'm about to fly, Rob.
Oh, sorry.
Like, straight from this room
but you're
to
not
the airport.
You're not going to get Homelander Superman on your plane, so don't worry.
Probably. I've actually been on two planes where Carl Urban has been on the plane.
Really?
So there's that chance.
He's pretty awesome, though.
Just randomly.
I do love him.
Yeah, I do love him.
But no, and by the way, the coolest thing they did on the show is in the comic book, because this was 2006 that they launched the comic. The lead character, Huey, was drawn to look exactly like Simon Pegg. And obviously Simon Pegg's too old to play the character. Huey's dad is Simon Pegg in the show. So and I didn't know that. So when he popped up, I was like, oh, that's really neat. And that's he does an excellent American accent.
Oh, nice.
Which I've never heard him do. So.
Did you watch all of it already?
No, I have a few more to go. I think it's 8 episodes on Amazon. They've already picked it up for a second season. The comic went 72 issues, which is kind of surprising to me. I remember after the initial arc, whatever it was, the first 12 issues, like, I remember just kind of lost steam for
me. I stopped reading after about 10.
I stopped, but the show is one of the better. I mean, I loved Preacher, and I just cannot get into that show.
Yeah, I tried.
Because it just doesn't capture the lunacy of Garth Ennis's writing. Yeah. This does. This is actually, and it's the same people. Apparently, it's like Seth Rogen's company that adapted. This, like, captures his tone perfectly. So it's funny, it's dark, it's fucked up, and it's got a lot going for it. So, you should check that show out.
Nice.
Now,
boys.
I saw something I've been traveling around, so as soon as I got here, I wanted to take advantage of the fact that a lot of stuff is not geo-blocked like it is in Australia. I'm like, oh, I really want to see this movie. I'm not available in your country. So as soon as I got in, jet-lagged as almighty hell, I logged into iTunes and I watched Darlin. D-A-R-L-I-N.
Wait, is that the new...
This is from Pollyanna McIntosh.
Yeah, the woman.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so this is like the third in a very unassuming trilogy. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, potentially there would be more.
Three different directors.
So the first one was Offspring. These are all based on Jack Ketchum books. With the exception of Darlin, which because Jack Ketchum passed away, I think, about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
And so this is an original screenplay that Pollyanna wrote. And so for those people who don't know, this is basically a cannibal series.
Is it still her same character from
The Woman? So basically
what's the first one?
Offspring.
The name of the book is Offseason.
Yeah. So there was Offseason, the book, which still exists and has never been adapted. Apparently it's caught up in Wright's Hell. I'm fairly certain that Eric Red was attached to it at some point or another, but it just never, ever happened. And then they adapted Offspring, which is kind of like it's clunky, but it's got a raw energy to it that I think that's kind of interesting. In a really bare bones kind of brutal approach.
Yeah. Bare bones, punny.
I'm here for all your puns.
No, there was a lot to that I remember it making me feel uncomfortable, like cow.
Yes.
The character of the cow.
Yeah.
I remember just watching. Well, I'd read the book beforehand, but then just even watching how it was cinematically portrayed and somehow the movie was even more raw than the book was.
Yeah.
And the book was horrible.
Yeah,
so
the book is
not horrible as in bad horrible. Horrible as in like a tough read.
Like it's a tough read.
Well, the first one, Offspring is directed by the producer of The Woman.
Andrew Vanderhounden.
Mm-hmm. Vanderhounden, yeah. And that's the only time he's directed.
I think he made one film before that. I think that was called Headspace. Which is a really interesting New York-based film.
Olivia Hussey, I think.
Maybe Larry Fessenden was involved in that. Or maybe that's the New York connection that I'm. It might have been a Glass Eye Picks release. I'm not exactly too sure. But yeah, he directed one of the film, but that film's got like a raw energy to it. And then it was then it was followed up by The Woman, which was directed by Lucky McKee. And he, I'm a big Lucky McKee.
Yeah, he knocked it out of the park.
He absolutely knocked that film out of the park. It is not for everyone.
Was that based on a book or did Lucky and him and Jack write it?
They wrote it as a screenplay and a book at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that was a really like a fruitful like relationship because they wrote a couple of other books together, all of which are really, really, really impressive. They wrote this amazing book called The Secret Life of Souls, which is about the relationship between a young girl and her dog. And it was profound, really moving story. So then there's The Woman, which is...
It's a sequel in a way because it is as if one of the cannibals from this clan that was presented in Offspring just kind of walks out of the woods one day and is then captured by this family.
Yeah, and so there's a patriarch who kind of literally catches this wild woman who's wandering out of the woods and takes her home, strings her up to domesticate her. Mm. It does not end well.
No, and the whole family take part. So it's kind of like a satire on the family.
Yes.
It's two movies in some ways. There's a horror film and then there's this great kind of over-the-top satire, which is really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of held together tonally by, Mickey's really, really interesting, filmmaking style. And it's got a really interesting score, really rocking kind of soundtrack. And I really like that film. It's something that I've come back to multiple times. And now that it's been followed by Darlin, which literally carries on from the end of The Woman and is written and directed by Pollyanna McIntosh.
So it begins with them walking into the woods?
Well, kind of walking out of the woods, but some time has passed. And The Woman is basically dropping off one of the children that she has co-opted and is now completely feral at a hospital for reasons that we don't completely know yet. and she's watching from outside to make sure that she gets in. Obviously, things don't go completely well in there. And this young child is then kind of brought into an orphanage that is run by nuns. It's like a convent. And they try to God the wild out of her, basically. Mm. And it's a really interesting film tonally. It's a little bit clunky here and there, but I think her direction is really, really smart. It's funny at times. It's very, very funny compared to the other stories in the series. It's got really great kids performances. Mm. And the central performance by the girl, I can't remember her name, as Darlin, is really, really interesting and nuanced. And then in the background, floating around as a constant threat, is Pollyanna McIntosh watching and waiting for her time to shine. And it goes some places. It's kind of like Sofia Coppola, but with a knife. I don't know how to describe it as anything other than that. There's a really kind of sensuous like lyricism to it, the way it's kind of put together. So it's a very interesting movie. It kind of maybe fumbles a little bit towards the end, but I would still recommend it quite highly. So I saw Darlin Yeah.
Nice.
That's excellent. Cool. Yeah, I'm gonna have to add that to my queue.
Yeah, it's not getting much of a shout out. It's kind of gliding by at the moment, so I felt that the need to kind of give it
I just find it interesting you went with the high class choice, because I know something else you saw, because we mentioned it. You saw The Carpenter.
Oh yes, I did watch The Carpenter What isn't The Carpenter?
Starring my hair.
Oh my god, Wings.
Hair.
Wings Hauser himself. Yes,
as a ghost carpenter.
That's right. So I was in Sacramento and caught up with the Keep Screaming podcast, and Brennan Klein, from the producer and one of the hosts of Queer Wolf, came down, and we all watched The Carpenter. That was his recommendation, and I was going into this movie based on the cover thinking, what on earth am I getting myself into? This looks like absolute tawdry trash, and little did I know.
There's a better cover than that one that is a little more accurate.
Yes.
There is another alternate cover that I remember seeing go, oh no, that's watchable.
The Carpenter is about a woman who essentially has a mental breakdown and is put in an institution by her husband, and then the husband buys a new home for her, for them basically to recover. She comes out and she's there, and this husband is a total wet rag of a guy. He's like a total pushover and mean and chauvinistic. And anyway, they've got this construction crew who are piecing the house back together bit by bit, and they're all lazy and monkeying around all the time. And then by night, the carpenter, Wings himself, is swooping in to like get shit done, basically. Yeah. And she's like, wow, this guy is just so erotic. And now this movie kind of takes on like this really amazingly unexpected feminist, like bent to it. And it's also really, really deliberately funny. There are moments where I'm like, oh my gosh, this is almost accidental Coen Brothers territory. Yeah. and then it is basically a slasher, because he's like knocking off all these other people, all these other workers, and it's all based around this morality stuff about work ethic. And it's like, you're a good carpenter, you're a bad carpenter, you're mean to your wife. And you know, like one of the guys is like making a move on this woman, and you know, Wings comes out to defend her, like chops off his arm. And yeah,
he's the opposite of Ramrod. I mean, this is like, yes, this is his good guy.
Yes, role. This is
he, even
this
though is, he's a ghost.
Yeah, exactly.
But I like his work ethic.
He does.
I think I'm going to side
good,
with yeah. Wings through much
I
of
think
this.
Exactly. And then on top of it, it's kind of got an almost like a supernatural bent to it as well, in that he's kind of got this psychosomatic relationship with this house, that he might be a ghost. He might have died, you know, in the past, and he's coming back, and he's like the personification of evil or whatever else. It's a little bit like Shocker. This is not a great movie, but it is very, very interesting.
Yeah. When did I watch? A couple of years ago, maybe, on here, or maybe a year and a bit ago. Just popped up on Amazon, and because it had Wings hair, I was like, I'm in.
Yeah.
But I thought it was pretty fun. Like, I didn't dislike it. I thought it was an interesting. It's definitely not what you think it's going
to
be.
It's so Canadian. Yeah. It's Canadian to the max.
It's tax shelter big time.
Yeah. There is a lot of tax shelters going on within the Carpenter.
That's good fun.
But Wings, he's an interesting guy.
I like him a lot. As you know.
Yeah.
I think I've gone to the ropes for Wings.
I am staring into the face right now of a man who loves Wings Hauser.
Wings Hauser love.
Hate proof.
So I spent, when we weren't at Camp Fango, I honestly spent a lot of time watching Shark Week. Shark Week!
All right.
Shark Week.
I'm Australian. Okay, every week is Shark Week down there.
Yeah, that's too real
in
Australia.
My favorites were Hair Jaws Strikes Back and Expedition Unknown Megalodon so far. But that's Shark Week. But then the rest of the time I've been binging the Friday the 13th series, which I assume you have been as well, Ulrich.
I'm behind. I know those ones really well, but the one I don't know well. Oh boy, unfortunately didn't get any better. I watched a whole hour of Jason on a Boat last night, as you can probably tell from my tweet, where Jason, I got really excited about the movie guy, the guy who makes movies, and I posted to Twitter. I got some great answers. I said, I just wonder what kind of movies he would have made if he had survived the boat.
I know, I saw
and
that.
A lot of people wrote back, and the best one was just somebody sent me three different pictures from Soderbergh movies, and they were dead on. It was like Sex, Lies, and Videotape, The Girlfriend Experience, and I'm like, that is exactly what he would have made. It's not a good movie.
I did 1 through 5. Okay. And
don't say too much, because we've got a whole show to talk about them.
I know. I'm just going to say that 2 I enjoyed a lot more than
good
I remember.
Slasher
it.
Film, right?
It's
yeah.
really good.
Really good.
I did not have fond memories of 2. It was just kind of like a throwaway title for me, but I don't think I'd seen it in probably 15 years.
Yeah.
And so that was definitely a nice rewatch. I definitely remembered 3 as being fun, which it still was, and 4 I'd always considered to be kind of the best constructed film.
I think it's a real movie, like in terms of like as a, it doesn't just feel like one of a series. It feels like a fully fleshed out storyline that could be self-contained.
contained. Like, mm-hmm. if there was no other movies around it, it would make sense as an
Yeah, and you could completely take Jason out of that and it would still feel great.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I absolutely love
that one. But we will be on Screen Drafts probably
Monday.
The week after. Yeah, it'll probably appear by next week. So when we have our Midsummer Scream episode, it'll probably be there, and it's probably going to be very strange.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a lot of arguing over crazy movies. It'll probably be 3 hours long.
It was hard to get through five.
Okay. But the good thing about five is the death scenes are amazing, but the, oh my God, some of the drama in that is the worst.
Well, and plus it wasn't at Crystal Lake. It wasn't Jason. It was just kind of.
Wait, it wasn't Jason? Who was it? It was my Halloween costume is who it was. Roy.
Yes, it was. It was actually.
That's probably the Halloween costume I'm most proud of, but also not the best movie. You love the movie.
I love it.
You love five? Seriously?
Yeah, sure.
I was so confused. It's been forever since I've seen it. As soon as the kid comes out with a candy bar, well, he's not a kid. He's like 25. But as soon as he comes out and is like, you want some of my candy bar? And the guy's chopping wood and is just like, fuck no. Fuck you and your candy bar. And then cuts him up with the axe. 12, I was just
it was
confused.
Awesome.
I will go.
Lots of boobs in it. I will say that.
Again, at 12, it was awesome.
Hot three.
Pamela Voorhees.
Hot three all the way.
Yeah, Pamela Voorhees.
I got to place that necklace around her neck, the Friday 13th 5 necklace when I did the panel for.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And this was one of the great stories of behind the scenes of Killer POV Shockwave stories where they chose the panelists and they chose me to do a movie that I'd always gone to the rafters saying how much I dislike, where Rob's a big fan of that one. Somehow they screwed it up.
What were they doing?
I can't know, but I know they actually asked me to do that one.
It was the same thing because they had me do the Rob Zombie panel for I can't even remember. No. It was the movie with all the circus clowns.
No,
but this had a good ending. What happened?
Like I've destroyed his movie.
But through the thing, I found a way to love it. Like so, it's like I had to watch it again with knowing I was going to do it, and then I kind of found my in. And by the end, I think the death scenes are actually really good and really brutal and really kind of ugly in that movie. It's like the neighbors' characters and stuff are just the worst.
Oh my God, they're terrible. You know? She's so greasy. But yeah, so I've been having fun revisiting them. I still do not enjoy Friday the 13th as much as Elm Street or even Hellraiser.
Don't tell people
matter.
Yet.
What?
Because now I'm getting insight.
No, you're
We're
not.
Against each other.
No, you're not getting any
But you didn't
insight.
Watch 6 yet, right?
I have not seen 6
yet. I think you're going to – I have a feeling that might become your favorite film.
I think
7
so
is usually
No, I know you're big, and that's why I'm saying. I think 6 has the playfulness of 7. It's still very much. It's a Tommy Jarvis story. It's
Your revisit of it is going to be, I think, different.
I'm curious. I'm going to probably do a rewatch on that one too.
And I do have to say,
it's well directed too.
Yeah, Corey's a really good actor.
Oh yeah, no,
and I when I was watching it, I was like, yeah, he was really good
and especially good as a kid actor. You know, he's a very good kid actor.
Yeah. And then I also do have to say, and the guys are going to roll their eyes, Hal Prince passed away this week, and he was a very, very famous and renowned Broadway producer. Rob just shook his head like, who the fuck?
Why would we roll our eyes at a death announcement?
Because I'm talking about Broadway. But
that may be, but if you're paying tribute to someone that died, I'm not going to roll my eyes
okay,
at that.
Okay, good.
I'll do
Hal
it.
Prince
Holy
died.
Shit.
No, but Hal Prince is legendary, produced like most of the major Broadway musicals for many decades, but the two that he did that definitely spoke to me a lot as a kid were Phantom of the Opera and Sweeney Todd, both of which were just as much kind of gateway horror drugs for me as, you know, Monster Squad was.
Wait, so he adapted Phantom of the Opera for Broadway?
No, he produced. He was a major, and he went on to direct. He directed Cabaret. He did a number of other things. But he started as a producer. West Side Story.
Okay, now I'm rolling
my eyes. He worked a lot with Sondheim.
You hit West Side Story. Now we're talking about Sondheim.
And we're out.
Who's good friends with Anthony Perkins.
Yes, sir.
So it does
bring it back.
Yes.
Very good friend.
Get it back quick, guys. Get it back quick.
And just to confirm, we are all very sad this man is dead.
Yes.
We are very, very sad.
He's a fucking legend. Yeah. So, yeah. R.I.P. Hal Prince.
Man.
Yeah.
How do we follow that up?
Yeah.
That's one of those like tonal shifts that's almost impossible unless your guest is Ricky Bates.
You'd have been
and
done.
Then it's kind of easy.
You know what was before we were going, what was the quote that you told him about his last movie, Trash Fire, that ended up being his favorite review of a movie?
Because
it was wonderful.
I can't remember anything I ever say, though.
You said,
I love
you said it was sad, hilarious, and something just like Ricky.
Oh,
and I thought it was.
Well, I guess I'm on brand. Wait, what did he say?
Did he use the word tragic?
Humorously tragic.
Tragic, hilarious. Yes, all right. So let's take a break, and then we'll bring our guest on.
Yes, sir.
Sounds good.
Today's episode is brought to you by Diabolik DVD.
featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolicdvd.com. They're the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolic DVD. Right now on Diabolic, we have new from AGFA. They have Blood Lake, Ninja Zombie, Lady Street Fighter, and lots more. We had a fun chat with them recently. They have all their new titles from Vinegar Syndrome, including Play Dead, Hellmaster, and Night Owl. And from Blue Underground, they have the all-new 4K restoration of the New York Ripper as a three-disc limited edition featuring a lenticular slipcover. Lenticular. I need a shower. Okay. So for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolicdvd.com or find them on Facebook.
We should get into this because I'm sad that I haven't seen you as long as I have.
I know.
To be honest.
Why has it been so long, Ricky? Where have you been?
You know, I finished the movie. I wrote two other movies. And Goobs and I are in pre-production. I wrote this pagan comedy that no one would finance because it's a pagan comedy. And then
define pagan comedy.
I don't really want to say more because I've already
said. Because I'm picturing like a Greek satyr play.
Well, it's about a coven in Ojai.
Okay, I'm in. I love covens and I love Ojai. I'm in.
I think it's good. Usually when no one else likes it, it ends up pretty good. So yeah, so Goobs really dug it and he was like, fuck it, man, let's just go make it. And then I was advised not to. Don't follow up your biggest budget yet with a pagan comedy, Ricky. Are you crazy? I booked this other sort of bigger movie because of Tone Deaf that looks like we're shooting in Georgia this fall.
So not like a Ricky Bates written and directed project?
No, well, Brian De Palma was actually attached to it for a while. Yeah. And then Tony Roman sent me the script. He actually used to work for Blumhouse. And I read it and I didn't really like it that much. And so I asked Tony if I could, you know, do my pass. And then I did the thing where I think I've been fired 4 or 5 times for this. Or like maybe more. But, you know, when it's, hey, do your director's pass and then I'll just rewrite it from scratch. And then they say, you know, what the fuck are you doing? Like this was never approved. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I've been fired for that a few times. Then, you know, I was expecting Noel to give me the your own worst enemy talk.
Your wife, Noel.
Yeah. After I sent it in. Because she, like, you know, she spoke with me about not doing that, about, you know, playing the game, if you will. You know. And they liked it. And they approved everything. Huh. And it was crazy. It's never happened. First time ever. Huh. And so I actually genuinely... it's very sort of, you know, if you like my movies, you'll like it. It's one of them.
So when you do a page one rewrite, that process, and there's not an, is there a kernel, an idea? Is there something in there that you're like, okay, wait, I like this. I can filter that through the way that I tell my story.
So
like, for example,
I'm not, like purely fucking crazy. Like if it's a, if it's a script about a panic room, I'm not going to take the panic room out of it because that's what sold it. But you know, I changed pretty much everything except for the first 8 pages or so. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'm psyched on it now. We're out to an actress as of Monday. We'll see what happens. I'm trying to keep making movies.
We need to fill in a lot of blanks. Okay. So first of all, we have Ricky Bates Jr. on the show. That's number one, which very excited about. And you have a new movie called Tone Deaf coming out August, end of this month, August 23rd.
I feel like he might be the only guest who, at least I know for me, it's true, has been on every one of your releases. I've been, because Excision, he was on Inside Horror.
Oh, wow.
He was on the video show.
Trash Fire, you were on, and then we had you on for Suburban Gothic as well, because for Suburban Gothic, we went, which is my favorite one of your movies.
I mean, I was at the LA premiere of Trash Fire. I assumed you came on. That's still my
the last two of my maybe tied, but I don't. Yeah,
we went to the premiere of Suburban Gothic.
You're definitely you're on the old China.
Yeah,
it's a
maybe I'm
it's,
wrong. Yeah.
It's a bit
you've
of a blur.
On, you've been on a lot.
I don't think you know. This is not. This
you've
is
got
not,
us on a dartboard. You're throwing darts.
You know, radio worthy or whatever the hell we're doing right here.
Yeah.
Podcast.
It's totally cool.
The point is, we have history together.
Yeah.
I genuinely love you all. This is actually, you know, I'm starting to wake up. Been in a room alone writing for 10 hours or so.
I've been thinking about a comment you made a few minutes ago, though, and I feel like you have to write a film for Brian De Palma now. Because I feel like because you got this gig, I feel like you have to write that next Brian De Palma film. Is that something we can do?
I don't.
I think him with your sense of humor could be fun.
I have I can't really say anything.
I'll take that that's already happening.
I want to because I want to, but I know that, like, you know, I shouldn't.
Uh-huh. So I'll just take that as confirmation. I'm completely right. You are writing the next Brian De Palma film.
Oh, no, that's certainly not happening.
Okay.
Don't listen to Elric. Right. Don't listen to Elric at all.
But I love Brian De Palma. Body Double is one of my favorite movies.
Me too, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So tell us how Tone Deaf kind of came into fruition, because we've heard about the Ojai Witches and some of the other stuff, but what happened that kind of brought Tone Deaf in?
Well, let's see. I'd finished Trash Fire, and I wrote a romantic comedy that I've been trying to get made for like 2.5 years with this actress, Aubrey Plaza. She was going to star in it, play twins, and produce it. It's like a very odd couple romantic comedy. I just pitched it as sort of a romantic comedy for people who could actually use one.
How does that not get made? I mean, if you have Aubrey Plaza attached, it seems.
Well, see, I did this thing. Trash Fire just premiered at Sundance, right? And I got, I thought that maybe people would give me more money than they would to make a movie. So I sat for the first time, I sat in a corner and I just like wrote not a feasible film to make that I cared about and wanted to. I wrote like a dream movie. You know, I need like a minimum $8 million to make a movie where half of it's about sexually transmitted diseases. So you understand, like, this is not an easy sell.
And this is your romantic comedy?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's okay. Sweet. It's very nice. It's very nice at the end. And yeah, so we're going to do that. And it sort of fell through. Like, Patton Oswalt liked it. And we just couldn't put like the cast together to get the money. And so I was hanging out with Noel, and the elections had just happened. And so we were sort of, you know, watching TV every day, sort of torturing ourselves, right? And I just felt like I needed to do something violent. And I asked her, you know, what scares you the most in the world right now? And she said, old men. And I said, okay. And I went to my corner. And 2 weeks later, I had a movie about it. And then I sort of kept refining it, you know, as things moved along. And, you know, even Tone Deaf, it was ready to go. I lost financing. And then we got it back, which was very exciting. But Tone Deaf, I had an amazing experience with the producers. Totally, you know, supportive, awesome. It's not always this way, but I've been super fortunate, man, because particularly with Excision and Trash Fire and Tone Deaf, you know, I have no complaints, you know, and most of my director friends sort of, you know, will walk away from a movie, you know, angry about one thing or another. It's just the way it goes, right? But I think I've been lucky because sort of the only people that would even dare to make a movie with me, having seen my other ones, are not going to be bashful about, you know, what we're doing here tonally or satirically or, you know, violence wise, you know, they're game. So, you know, it was cool. I had fun and I loved that. Everyone was nice. It was actually, God, it was like 2 years ago. That was a pleasant experience.
Who did you write the Robert Patrick role in mind? Do you not do that? Like, was it based on anyone in your mind as the type?
For Robert Patrick, I wrote the role, which you're not even going to believe this, having seen the movie, because, you know, he talks a lot. but I wrote the role without any dialogue. And then I spent like 2 months taking screen grabs of various relatives' Facebook posts. And I sort of compiled them all together to sort of create this extreme and absurd caricature that's really based on a bunch of baby boomers' Facebook posts.
Were they all like old white men, or were they like your mom's in there too? Well, there was your sister?
Mostly old white men. One or two old white women. But yeah, so that's sort of, I don't want to say who because, you know, I don't know. I just want people to leave me alone at this age.
I don't think anyone's going to ask you to list your Facebook friends here. I think we can let that
list
slide.
Your family.
Yeah, as if my family in like Mississippi is listening.
Yeah, exactly. Wait, I think you got a dig in at us too just then. Yeah. Wow, I wanted to be listened to by.
Yeah,
I know, but it also explains
it was
why.
Not on purpose.
it kind of explains why. I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing where we're at now in terms of communication. So, like, obviously, we see each other every week because we do the show. But you kind of disappeared from social media completely, mm-hmm. probably around the time of Trash Fire, if not before that.
Well, it was just making me sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I just assumed you were concentrating on just work, writing and stuff like that. But, it's interesting to hear that this movie was kind of birthed from maybe some of the reactions and things you were seeing.
Yeah, it was entirely a result of the election. I mean, the movie in and of itself sort of I'm most interested to watch it in like 10 years because it sort of exists as like more than anything, like a cultural artifact, you know, and I try to make each of these movies like, you know, feel like a human being, feel like me, because that's, you know, what I most love about movies when I, you know, I'm thinking about the director the whole time or anything. Why would he do that? Would he do that? You know, it's personal to me. In fact, if I, you know, if I had ran a studio, I, at this point, everything's so sort of homogenized. I think I would just give, you know, a couple $100,000 to 30 people that never made a movie in their life and say, you know, make whatever you want. I just want to see it. I want to see what the hell's going on in there. That's fascinating to me, you know, and that's, you know, but, you know, you either get something amazing or you get Freddy Got Fingered.
Which is amazing moments.
Which I actually.
When he gets inside the creature.
I've seen it like at least 15. I want to like it.
Yeah.
I watch it.
Yeah.
I watch it again. I don't like it. Yeah. I watch it again. I don't like it. Yeah. The same thing with Antichrist. I saw in the theater.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. Yeah. I bought it on DVD. I didn't like it. I've watched that movie more times than most movies I like.
They're basically the same movie, though.
I don't ever.
They're both about a dead creature that turns around and
there's
says,
"Something
Chaos
about
Reigns,
those
them,
two
you know?
Movies that they're the two that I watched. I've watched both those movies more than any movie I love."
Actually, I'm actually kind of serious because when I think about it, Lars von Trier is kind of like him personality wise. When you think about, he's like always trying to poke. And
oh no, I didn't think you were joking.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, wait, you're my target audience.
That made sense to me.
Well, I mean, what I love about your films every time, and I think Trash Fire was like, I found Trash Fire to be a real huge leap, you know, like, and not to say, not a leap in quality or what you're trying to say, but just felt like it all kind of came together. I could see your, because I love that you've got there's a bit of Woody Allen, a bit of Todd Solondz, a bit of these kind of voices, this comedy tone, that a dark comic tone, which is not easy to pull off. Well, I think as directors, I think on the page, a lot of that might look good, but I think sometimes it's very hard to translate. But then you're also playing with these tonal shifts into horror. So, and we were talking off air before how you were finding divisive, you know, responses occasionally to that. But I love that we can start. I mean, this movie, like, you know, starts Gilmore Girls-y the dialogue, but even more like satirical, and then takes me to a gothic haunted house movie.
Well, in the office scenes, I was walking around yelling more CW.
Ah. That's and, your direction. More CW.
Yeah. Over. Yes, it was.
Like Christopher Walken, more cowbells.
More CW. We had a lot of fun making that movie. I mean, look, it's exciting to me. I'm lucky to get to do this, right? Because I'm making movies the way that I want, that I like movies. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like I have no... I'm not particularly attracted to subtlety in any way, shape, or form. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to – I'm not trying to make Manchester by the Sea. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I want to make, like, the Who's Tommy, mm-hmm. you know? And so – and also, particularly with a movie about right now. I don't. If you're trying to capture a moment, I don't think subtlety has any place in it. You know what I mean? It's.
But your target isn't. What's cool about it is, I think some people might listen to this and go, "Oh, this is just some Trump attack movie."
No,
the attack in the first 10 minutes is clearly on the protagonists and kind of millennials and the way they're just literally tethered to their phones and the way they're just communicating and everything's very false. But you, over time, you look behind that and show actually quite different characters throughout the film.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't win out in this fight, but I did want the tagline, you know, I did want posters to just say in big fonts, "You're all full of shit." And that's all I want, you know, I want it to be, "You're all full of shit." And that's, I mean, that is sort of the basis for the film. You're all hypocrites. Everyone's a hypocrite. Everyone's full of shit. But, you know, there are some people trying to do good and there are others who are, you know, completely motivated by self-interest, right? So that's, at the end of the day, what differentiates the two.
I mean, I feel like there's one person who's truly good in this movie, and that's Uriah. Is he named after Uriah Heep?
Yeah, but even Uriah is full of shit.
No,
you know, and I don't even mean that because, you know, people think that I maybe am hard on my characters, but I love them all. You know, yeah. I'm full of shit. You know, I don't identify with people in movies that aren't. They don't feel real to me. You know, so I don't make any of these movies thinking negatively about really anyone.
But I mean, you do set that up because, like, let's, and I won't do spoilers, but you could watch the Robert Patrick character and instantly hate him. But at a key moment, he does something, I won't say to protect the lead character, but in a way it is. And it instantly buys you time, I guess, to spend with him where you can still kind of watch him and not judge him and
right.
be
you
there.
Know, the
you
worst know? Person in the world's yeah. done good things yeah, and yeah. the nicest person in the world's done awful things.
So yeah.
You know, that's just sort of the way it is, right? So I think by leveling the playing field like that, then you can start having a discussion. But it's the holier-than-thou attitude that even prevents, you know, people from admitting that maybe they're hypocrites about one thing or another, anything, just to sort of, you know, have a sit down conversation. So the idea of the movie was, you know, is something John Waters always said to me, if you want to make a point about anything, make people laugh. Hmm. So that always sort of stuck in my head.
Was it always a horror? Did you always know the horror side of this? Because it is interesting. You do have like real horror tones. Like, it's not just like, oh, it's set in a horror setting. The whole entire, there's some genuinely creepy and effects laden like moments in this and beats.
Yeah.
Obviously, Levin Palmer, who's fantastic in Suburban Gothic.
Ray
Wise. Sorry.
I
got to remember. But he's got a really, you know, he's got a pivotal kind of thing in this. I don't spoil it for people. But some of the stuff that like really has really creepy dread beats, but they're punctuating things that are also really humorous or strange.
Well, right. So that was the most important thing, right? Because I knew I was going to make a mixtape. Because during all the, you know, the election and all this stuff, there is no such thing as a week that goes by where it's a fucking one note tone poem. Okay. You know, there's no right or wrong way to make a movie. And I'm, you know, I'm not interested in making a movie like that. But over the course of 7 days, I can feel like I'm in a comedy and a horror movie, 40 different fucking movies, right? So, and I wanted that to come across. So we pushed that very hard, but I structured it very tightly and traditionally. So, in fact, if I hadn't made the film like that, jumping from sort of tone to tone to tone, you know, mood to mood to mood, and I just played it straight, you would find, you know, your sort of more standard horror film.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's exciting about it was sort of, you know, playing with all these things.
Oh, and as an audience, it's like having no clue what you're going to do next. It's playful, you know?
Yeah, and you know, I did love both the leads so much. Amanda and Robert were so fucking fun. Like, there's not one time, you know, I say a lot of crazy shit. Like I get so excited. It starts to feel like I'm a kid again, and I just start running around yelling ideas. Some of them ridiculous that I want to try, you know, and every once in a while, one of them's awesome, you know, after we get the take. But a lot of the time, they fucking suck. So not once did either of them ever say no, and they loved it. You know, we had, it was like camp almost. It was such a blast, you know. And I had enough time to do, you know, some real pre-production on this one. So everything was, you know, boarded and laid out and sort of meticulously planned out so that, you know, we could loosen things up a little bit. I didn't really allow improv dialogue-wise, but I don't necessarily even like saying that because they do 800 million things actor-wise that aren't in the script. You know what I mean? Variation. So it's, improv with dialogue, I guess. You know? Although Robert did say my favorite line in the movie. I didn't write it, unfortunately. When he says he's at the bar and he says, don't hold back on the cherries.
Yeah, that's a good one. About a Shirley Temple.
Yeah, that's my favorite line. And I didn't write it.
You Ari Aster's movie is like 2 hours, 40 minutes to say what you say in the first four. And I'm super impressed by that because your breakup scene's probably as good as it. And I love this too. Don't get me wrong. I love Midsommar, but I think that's one of the strongest points.
That's the first scene I heard. Yeah,
What's the actor's name? He was in The Littlest Reich too. He's hilarious in that.
Nelson.
Yeah, so that's his name.
Nelson Franklin. He's my buddy from college. He was in my short film.
But he's in The Littlest Reich, right? He's hilarious in that.
He's in Veep.
He's the Jewish guy who's like fighting the Nazis, and there's some great lines with him in that.
He's going to be in my pagan comedy.
Yeah.
But he seems like almost a good stand-in for you for those scenes. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though it's no one's necessarily a straight stand-in, but he's funny.
I love him. He's really good.
But it's the best. If only all breakups were that congenial simple and to the point, and then it's like, okay, good. Now fuck off.
It is one of my favorite breakup scenes.
Yeah, it is. It is exciting, though, even to get away with that, right? Because you write a breakup scene to open up a film, and the note you're going to get is, you know, where's the conflict? Where's the drama? You have to cut out at that point, you know. But no, it's just fucking that really excited me that I got to do that.
Well, it's still thematically on point, the idea that everything, like when your phone isn't working, you can just trade in for another phone. And that seems to be how they're trading in relationships.
Well, certainly, and for the first time, like I even shot the close-ups wide in this movie. And we spent so much time on the production design because, you know, in sort of an effort to make this like a cultural artifact, everyone's sort of things, possessions are such a representation of themselves. So, you know, I mean, that's what we do now. I guess we've always done it, but we have more things, right? So we shot everything wide and spent a lot of time making every little detail in the sets, you know, mean something. Mm. Whit Lee Poindexter, I was the production designer, and she's amazing. I really just liked everyone on this movie. I'm trying to think if there was anyone I didn't. There was one grip.
All right.
That one grip. Fuck that guy.
But
girl.
I'm not naming names.
Well, you know, I want to talk about Amanda, because the strength of all your films, which I find fascinating, is you seem to always nail it with the lead. These characters are always so complex, and basically all the way back to Excision through now, it's like you've always had this great, strong female lead as your character. You seem to have a knack for finding that person. How do you go about finding who's going to be that character? And in terms of directing, like, is there a sense when you – basically, do you have coffee with somebody and get just a general sense of them as a person if they're going to be able to pull off what your character is? Because, again, it's like on all four films, you've had, like, the perfect lead actress.
Well, it's a combination of things, right? So when you write the movie, I don't really think when I'm writing a girl, I don't really think about it being a boy or a girl. I just think about it being a lead. I don't have them say things that I would think a girl would say or a guy would say. I just have them, you know, I guess say what I want them to say. And so I'm not thinking about cast at all when I write it at all. In fact, I usually will finish a script, then I'll sit down, I'll put it down, and then I won't start thinking about who I would even, you know, in a perfect world, consider until about a few weeks to a month later. Because I don't want, because then sometimes when you think of someone, then you start writing for them, mm-hmm. and you deviate from the character.
Yeah, it influences you.
Right. When and the actor is much more excited by you not writing for them. They don't want, you know what I mean? They're mm-hmm. they're in this to not be themselves, you know? So with this film, I met with, God, I want to say like maybe 40 girls.
How do you run your auditions? Like, do you just have them read or do you have them do specific stuff or is it personality based?
I usually just talk to them. I mean, you know, when I found Angela for Trash Fried, met with so many people and she was sad and funny and I just, and that movie was so personal and I was like, and I had to really like her. You know what I mean? And so I picked her because I, quite frankly, everything she sort of said and did was sort of like the type of person that I spend time with, kind of, you know, very sort of self-deprecating, very, you know, highs and lows, you know. With this, it was sort of, I know who this character is on the page, but I don't want to be resigned to it. You know what I mean? What if someone has something that would make this character a lot more exciting? But we reached out to Amanda after I was watching, well, I love Silicon Valley a lot. But I usually watch a lot of YouTube videos, you know, like when they're guests on late night shows, when they're on the spot. And she was hilarious, like genuinely hilarious on, I remember this like Conan video. And I was like, oh, this is perfect because she's subtle. I mean, she is a real deal actress, okay? She is so thoughtful and, God, she's nuanced. You know, she'll bring so much to it. So, you know, sometimes I have to, for this movie, push her to exaggerate more, mm-hmm. you know, which I tend to have to do on most of my films because it's not, you know, because they all take place in these heightened realities, right? So there's a lot of truth in them, but, you know, it's not a real version of this world. It's my version, I guess, or the way I sort of see it or saw it at the time, which is the most fun thing about these movies, right? Because I can watch any of my old ones. And, you know, I know a lot of people say they don't watch their movies or whatever, but I after a few years, I love to because I know everything about the way I was thinking and feeling then.
Mm. Do you still feel, and this is not just your movies, like all filmmakers see it, do you still see the things that didn't work out the way that you intended them to? I think that most filmmakers have, like, they'll see the one shot and go, oh, I wish I could have done it differently. Or do you forget about it by that time?
You know, I try not to think about that at all. There was with Suburban Gothic, I did think that. But I try not to think like that at all because the reality is if I ever waited for the perfect situation to make a movie, I would never have one movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I take them also personally. It is a funny thing, right? Making these movies because you have to take it completely personally and make an extension of yourself to care enough to do a good job to ask someone to pay for it. And then especially when I play with all these tones and things, right? And I know I'm asking for trouble when I do that, right? Like some it's, you know, they're all sort of movies, right? That someone's going to love and someone's going to fucking hate, you know, but I'm never prepared for that. Each time, you know, when I read that someone doesn't like it, I'm still bummed out, but I think
that's only if you don't do it well. I think you do it well, so I don't think they have to love it or hate it. I don't think your tones are so wildly disparate that they don't come together. I think that's actually what makes your films interesting, is that they do come together. You're not, I'm not watching two different movies. I'm watching, like, you're trying different things, but when they land all together, almost cumulatively, they work.
Well, certainly. Well, and I try to do them in even doses.
Right.
Right. So tone deference, this is, you know, it's like comedy, drama, horror, comedy, drama, horror. Right. Mm-hmm. And it was, we went through the script doing that. Mark. You know, someone's always going to have a favorite of those genres.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very interesting. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of what I'm so fortunate to be able to have done, because, you know, it's very hard to get my movies financed because of that.
Yeah. But it's like, so
I was here with a few scripts and they said, what the fuck is that?
That wasn't us though.
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't.
I would have hired him for Predator Purge. That would be utterly fascinating.
I really want to see the Ricky Bates Insidious sequel. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my new one, it's going to be very cool to see what the hell anyone thinks of it. Cause it's an action suspense movie.
Which is this, the Ojai Witches?
No,
or
the Brian De Palma.
The Brian De Palma. Yeah. Okay.
But it's completely in sort of one of my heightened realities.
You keep calling this a cultural artifact, and as your publicist, I'm going to step in here and say that's great that he does
right over
whatever.
There.
I'm a nice publicist now. He wants to wait 10 years, but he wants you to see it while it's out because it is timely. So we're not going to push it on that. But one thing I like that is actually
you should see it now because it's also a good movie to argue with your friends about, I think.
Well, but I think it's fair. I know you might think this too, but I actually think it's this incredibly fair film because you actually set up some really interesting ideas that I think about quite a lot, which is both characters are haunted. So it's not like one character is haunted. You've got both characters and they're both equally haunted and really, you know, really quite dark.
And they're both haunted by the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Essentially the same thing. But the way, so what I see when I kind of step back from just the narrative of a movie like this is I'm seeing a very fair, in a way, portrait of both types of people, almost saying like, look, they both have shit. They both think they're entitled. They both think they're right. But there's not besides the violence committed by one character, there isn't that much daylight separating them. And that there is another realm without the violence where they could have gotten along probably just pretty well in the right situation.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. That was super important, right? Because if you're just preaching to the choir, there's no reason to make a movie at all, you know?
But that seems to be almost a summary of our times. Like if people could just get in a room, a lot of people, no matter how far extreme we are on social platforms, it does feel like there's a lot of things that if we're in the room could actually get cut through the noise, probably you could actually get along with each other. And,
sure.
But how the fuck do you do that? Maybe right. This is a movie saves our souls.
I
that's my thesis.
United humanity
with Ricky's
movie. Death. Ricky, did you know you were doing that when you wrote it?
I don't hear that a lot.
You solved politics.
That'd be something, huh?
Right. It'd be good timing.
I certainly would like to have people have conversations about it. But yeah, I went to great lengths to not take sides because it's very easy to take sides. You know what I mean? It's almost lazy to you know. I'm liberal, right? I'm a registered Democrat or whatever, you know. But I to pander to my own audience is so sort of just tasteful almost.
We've already seen the result of what that is. If everyone lives in their bubble, you see what happens.
Well, right. So it's like a movie to me like Chaney, right? Like I'd love for my relatives in Mississippi to watch a movie about Chaney and maybe consider why he might not be so good. But if they were to watch that movie, they would just be like, you arrogant fuck liberals thinking you're so much cooler than us as usual, making fun of me, like, you know, turn off 10 minutes later, you know? So I guess in that sense, I am fortunate enough to have like half my family from the South, right? So, and I grew up in a place where a good amount of my neighborhood friends growing up were Republicans. You know, I was the fucking freak that moved to New York and went to art school and wore skinny jeans when I could fit into the goddamn things. you know? So you remember those days. It wasn't long ago, but it feels like a long time.
You didn't eat the rhubarb pie. You're good.
Yeah, dude.
I shouldn't have mentioned rhubarb again. I know I'm tempting it.
I love rhubarb. I really love rhubarb.
Becca made it, and it's really good, but yeah, we're not going to tempt you anymore.
You don't see a lot of rhubarb pies.
They
got a rhubarb soda at Trader Joe's right now.
Really?
Yeah, it's like
wow.
Rhubarb and strawberry.
Wow.
I can't have that either. what are we talking about? Movies?
We're talking about horror films.
We're talking about horror films or anything.
So I'm always intrigued by what you are watching because when I've had past conversations with you, the movies that you are attracted to a lot of times kind of echo your sensibilities. And so I remember that last time you were odd, I was really amused by some of your recommendations. So what have you watched recently that you were kind of like, yeah, this connects with me?
Goodness, Rebecca. I've been sort of in my own little world. I spent so much of my youth watching everything I could get my hands on that now I'm almost afraid to watch too much that I might take something accidentally.
Oh.
So, you know, I watch a lot of documentaries. What did I see? Oh, there was one movie. I loved Beach Bum. I saw it twice in the theater.
I'm dying to see that.
It's my favorite
Harmony
movie.
Korine World.
So that's what I want movies to be like. That movie, okay, takes place in exaggerated reality, and it's completely from this man's brain. Mm. I am there, and I am in his head. And that's so exciting to me. You know what I mean? It's so much more exciting than sort of, you know, this is a story. It's one of five, you know, sort of outlines that we sort of pull from.
You want someone to go all in on whatever they're doing.
Absolutely. And I want to feel that person, mm-hmm. you know, I want it to be idiosyncratic. I want it to shift and change and warp, you know, like sort of having a conversation with, you know, with anyone. Or maybe I'm just talking to a bunch of cases. But that movie's amazing. I loved it so, so much. And
so films don't influence your film at the time of writing. Like you try to stay away from things when you're making this one?
Films influence the shit out of my films, right? Because
subconsciously.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I grew up just staying, you know, in my parents' basement, you know, just watching movies all day and, you know, anything I get my hands on. And college, and then, you know, you do drugs for a while and that's exciting, but then that's, you know, starts to not be fun.
No, wait, what area of DC were you in? Were you a video vault kid?
No, so I was like 20 minutes outside DC. So
okay.
I was in Northern Virginia.
Okay.
You know, I think I have a learning disability with directions because I still can't fucking drive to DC from my childhood home. Do you know, if my ways broke on my way home from here, I would be fucking
lost.
Would
never see you again. Huh?
Oh, I'm – no, well, that's L.A.
No, I'd probably start
actually,
crying.
When I first met you, I was doing a show and
dude,
I'll never
you
forget.
Drove me.
No, but I'll never forget. I walked out. We said goodbye. I walked downstairs and you were walking – along in the wrong direction, away from wherever it is that you should have gone. And I literally pulled up and I said, dude, you want to ride? And we went the other way. All so right. I actually remember you going the wrong way.
Eric, I'm not lying to you here, buddy. I seriously think I have a fucking problem.
Yeah. I'm really good with directions, as Becca.
No, you are not.
So maybe we share this.
He
disability.
Has gotten lost so many fucking
oh, well, I'll
times.
Drive around the same block.
And I'll be like, what are you doing?
It's
we just went
issue.
Around this block. We have had this and every single time now. I'm sorry. Like, can I drive? And you won't let me drive your stupid Prius. And yeah.
This isn't about me. This is about his psychoanalysis.
Let's make it about you.
I think we need to get to the root cause of Ricky.
I'd rather talk about your problems and then let's talk,
I talk about
my problems.
All the time.
And
I,
then.
And then work it out.
And then
together.
Let's work it out.
Yeah. We can just watch movies.
I have no idea what's going on.
You remind
on.
Me of
yeah, problems. My problems are minimal. Right
was that me
now.
And you and
yeah,
everyone?
Yeah, actually, you know, Rob seems fine. I turned to Rob and I was about to say, and Rob's problems. And I was like, this guy's fucking happy as a clam.
Yeah. Rob's got a shit together.
I rarely
together.
See this guy this smiling.
I know.
It's amazing.
Isn't it crazy?
It's joy. It's fucking great, man.
Yeah, I mean, just don't come on. Back next week.
I mean, yeah.
Could all cry. No. Oh, yeah. Luckily, you're away for a couple weeks.
I'm away
you're
for a few weeks.
You're going to get some R&R.
You're my last guest for this month.
I don't want to see you crack, man.
I'm not going to cry. Everything's going to be fine.
You know, it's funny. When I was sort of, you know, Trashfire was sort of like this fucking personal exorcism type thing. And I was doing the, had a camera ready and I was doing the title sequence. So I was going to carve Trashfire in my arm, like right here, you know? And then my wife started crying.
With
and she's like,
effects?
No.
With like a knife?
Yeah, I thought it'd be like the right way to, you know, not hurt my, you know, I mean, that's a hell of an opening title sequence. Uh-huh. The director carves the movie's name into his arm.
It's like something Cecil B. DeMented would have done.
Sort of, it is, and yeah. I do, and I love that movie.
Yeah, I do too.
I love that movie.
And your wife
stopped
you.
When they get Fassbender branded.
Yeah, no, she started crying and yelling at me. She's like, you're telling me you're going to carve the fucking title of the fucking movie and you're fucking, and it's Trashfire? That's the fucking.
That's kind of my reaction there.
Yeah, no, she's probably right. Those were some weird years, you know? Those were some weird.
But I remember that script, and it was because that one I got to see pretty early, and I was pretty amazed with how you pulled that off.
It's a miracle it exists. I mean, imagine selling a movie that by design doesn't have a third act. Hmm. I mean, I've been very fortunate to make these things.
Mm-hmm. With Tone Deaf, was Tone Deaf cathartic then? Because in terms of like now that it's, I mean, it's not out there yet though, but like in terms of some of the stuff you were dealing with, obviously you're taking what's around you, a lot of this noise, putting it into your vision and then putting it out in the world. Has that helped?
Certainly. Yeah. All of them. That's mm-hmm. why I love movies so much. Right. Yeah. And I try to keep making them, you know, I mean, you know, for the, what I got, I got four movies so far. Now that I got off the internet, I'm writing. I mean, I can knock out a first draft in a month. It's not good till the fourth draft, but mm-hmm. I can have, you know, in a few months, I can have, you know, 5-6 scripts and then, you know, start fine tuning them all. But I mean, I'm working round the clock to have four movies, you know. Someone was telling me that. What it's like 30% of directors who direct one movie make a second one. And I don't know, I'm sure some of it is, yeah, it's really interesting. And you know, I think that, right, like I went to like a nice like fancy film school at NYU, and no one, at least a lot of my class, you know, I just felt very frustrated with because they didn't try. I mean, there are kids that, you know, we work so hard to get in that senior year class to be able to make a movie, right? And a handful of them never even did, and they got picked and took someone else's spot. And it's, you know, I'm just frustrated with anyone that doesn't take it seriously, you know.
I mean, not to do too political, but like last night, Warren had a great line where she's like, why go through all the trouble of running for president if you don't want to do anything, if you just want to say no to everything? And that reminds me of the attitude some people approach anything with.
Sure.
Like you work really hard, and then when the thing comes, you go, eh.
And I think a lot of people have this notion that, you know, making movies is fun because it was when you had a camcorder.
Right.
When you're a kid, and then you make one, you're like, holy fuck, I'm yelling at people. People are yelling at me. You know, this isn't exactly how I envisioned
There's
it
no
when
money.
Nothing was happening. I wrote a movie for this amount of money. I was told I was going to have it, but I don't even have 1/10 of it. You know, 8 million things. But like, I never really get bummed because if I have enough, I'm going to fucking make a movie and try to make it as good as possible, mm-hmm. which is, you know, which goes to, you know, that's, and my buddy Matthew Gray Gubler has been such a awesome pal with all this. Like, you know, we love this, this pagan comedy, and everyone turned it down. You know, Dave Lawson, who did Trashfire, tried to get it financed. But you know, again, and Goobs was like, fuck it, man, let's just do it. We're literally doing it for nothing. You know, which is such a disturbing thought to all your representatives, right? You know, this is like, what are you fucking doing? Mm-hmm. You know, you almost have a career, Ricky. and you want to make a fucking pagan comedy for like five? Like, yeah. What are you doing? You know, I just love movies. I just love making them. I'm in my happiest when I'm making them, for sure. You know, And this will be a fun one because I think Noel will help out. And that was, you know, the most joyous thing for me about Tone Deaf is that it's Noel's favorite of any of my movies.
Aww.
And that, you know, that made me really happy. And it's, you know, she really likes it.
You were talking about Gubler, and I have to say one of my favorite kind of Hollywood moments that we had is, I think it was right after Killer POV, you invited the three of us to come to the premiere of Suburban Gothic here in LA. And it was at the theater in Los Feliz. I can't remember the name of it. And
Vista.
The Vista. Yeah. And so we get there and we had like drinks at that Chinese restaurant near it beforehand. And then we get to the theater and there is literally lines around the block of like 13-year-old girls in pajamas. And we went in, and I think we were the oldest people in the audience by far.
I didn't know the power of Gubler.
Yeah, we like, were not aware of the power of Gubler, but apparently he had tweeted out like, hey, I'm in this movie, and there's a scene where I'm in my pajamas, so wear pajamas. And it was hundreds.
We had to add
like,
screenings.
Literally, yeah. The theater was full of like teenage girls in pajamas. And
Ricky wore pajamas, too.
Are you telling me that those girls weren't there for me?
They may have been. All I know is that we were there and not in our pajamas.
We were there for you.
We were there for you.
Thanks. That's great.
The real view of the audience.
No, actually, that's nice. So now I can confirm that I had three people there. No one has been more good. Did I ever tell you how I met Goobs?
No.
So I was cast. So when I made Excision, you know, I just sort of made up how to make a movie because I didn't know. But I knew I wanted to make one. So one of my friends was a PA on that show, Criminal Minds. And I was like, hey, don't they have a casting director? Don't TV shows have casting directors? She's like, yeah. And I was like, can you just give me the guy's number? And he was like, okay, but don't say I gave it to you. Don't get me in trouble or whatever. And I called and the dude met with me and we were talking and this was at, you know, my prime time shady hipster look. And the dude was like, there's this guy on the show. He's totally nuts. You guys could be like best friends. It's crazy. And I was like, please don't walk me on set. I do not want to meet anyone. You can't do this to me. And he walked me on set and was like, hey, Goobs, get over here. I was like, and, you know, we shook hands and it was really weird. And I was like, actually kind of pissed off, to be honest.
Had you even watched the show at that point?
I watched it. I watched the episode because my friend wrote an episode. And, you know, we were all super excited for it. It was a huge thing.
Yeah.
You know, so we all watched it. But and then I got home. And then that night I get a call and he's like, hey, it's that guy Goobs from the show. And I was like, what? He's like, let's go drink some whiskey, huh? I was like, yeah, shit, I drink whiskey. And then we've just been like great pals ever since. So it was just crazy like that. But yeah, he was going to do Tone Deaf, but stuff with his book got in the way, which...
What would he have been in Tone Deaf?
The cowboy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, makes sense.
Great character.
But that's not a good... character for a guy with a children's book coming out to play.
Goobs from a children's book?
Yeah, it was number one on New York Times bestseller a few weeks in a row. Like, real deal. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, what's it called?
And it's good. It's called, I think it's called Rumple Buttercup.
Wow. That's kind of adorable.
Something like that. But, you know, and that's, you know, Robert Patrick was like, where's Goobs? Where's Goobs? You know, people seem to really enjoy this Goobs guy. But Robert and I became really close, which is another fascinating thing about this because, you know, politically we are a little bit different. And at first that was exciting to me for someone who, you know, again, he's a very reasonable guy. He's in no way, you know, extreme whatsoever. But, you know, he's more conservative leaning than me for certain. And so I thought that'd be exciting for Harvey because he would be impassioned to represent him properly rather than someone that would want to mock that character, you know. And we became super close. We had a long talk after South By about how sort of this movie kind of opened our eyes to sort of both sides of things. Even I still had some, I'm sure, you know, bits of, you know, arrogance and stuff towards certain things, you know, and he had, you know, and he would scoff at certain things that I don't think either of us react like that anymore. But it was so fun because since you've seen the movie, I called Robert, and you know, whenever Amanda's hands are fighting him, right, attacking him, I called Robert. It's like, Robert, you know, you've got a millennial daughter, right? And he was like, yeah. I was like, we need to have her do the hands throughout the movie that are hurting you. And so he's like, oh, great. Let me ask her. And so we brought her in, and she's like super pumped. So all the inserts ever, you know, when all that stuff happens, it's actually his daughter doing that to him.
Why is that?
His real millennial daughter. And she was covered in blood, I remember. And I was like, oh, I'm so, you know, I don't want Robert Patrick mad at me. Okay. Yeah. This is the most fucking masculine man I've ever met in my life. I feel like a child.
I think we went to the bathroom with him that one time at Texas Frightmare. Yeah. We were like, holy shit, we're peeing next to Robert
Patrick.
I
can't remember.
Yeah, you said something funny.
Well, he's funny as hell, too. Yeah. Right? But yeah, she was covered in blood. And I was like, you know, I'm so sorry. You know, I know, I think we ruined your clothes. And she's like, don't worry. We love blood in the Patrick family. and he loved that. He's like, you know, I'd never seen a more proud father when I told him that. He's like, ah, oh, that's my girl.
Wow.
Yeah. So we, you know, usually the cool thing about these movies, about making them sort of personal, is that I do form these bonds with the cast typically, you know, because we're all sort of, you know, I relate to them, you know, they're sort of the ones like, oh, you know, it's an actor, it's a crazy actor. Oh, it's a director, it's a crazy director. You know, it's like, you know, we're both kind of in that same boat and trying to make the best thing possible. And, you know, it forms a lot of sort of camaraderie, I guess, when you're making one of these things.
If that didn't sell you, there's also lots of violence and gore. And it's still a horror film.
Oh,
you know, that's the thing.
I endorse this movie. Yeah. This is a good movie.
Okay, so got your seal. Okay, well, that's good.
That's good to know.
I would tell you if I didn't like it. I am that bad at business.
Yeah,
I really am. It's actually pretty much exactly what it was supposed to be. What it was by design from sort of a lookbook stage, you know, and that's what was so cool with these actors. The comedy. I don't necessarily know that either of them would have done the movie if it wasn't a comedy. You know, that sort of was particularly exciting to them.
Well, you're right, though. If it was just a horror film, it'd be a pretty one note kind of. It's like you've seen that setup.
I structured it like the most traditional slasher film. So then we could just, you know, so then hopefully I could get away with sort of remixing.
Yeah.
You know,
You know, Beckett asked you before about movies, but I'm just curious if there's any other things that I don't know, that are kind of influencing you or just getting you through these days, whether it's music or reading or whatever, because, you know, I find solace in music.
I love music.
I buy all these art of books, like the art of, you know, I just got the new Alien, the Making of Alien book, movie from whatever, 40 years ago, and I still love seeing behind the scenes photos and stuff. I don't know. It's just, and it's part of my whole setup. Like I'm insane about physical media and I've equated it to that. I just like being surrounded by art, you know, because that's what the video store was, right? You're like surrounded by art, literally, physically, and literally it's people's art. And I just look up and I'm like,
Rob,
oh, shit, I'm
I want to hug you right now.
Okay.
Okay. this is everything that I ever want to hear, because this has been sort of one of my sort of small problems with a lot of movies now, with these film schools, and they're all sort of taught to make a movie one way. But more importantly, they just watch movies. And how can you have sort of a well-rounded, you know, artistic viewpoint if you're not going to museums, looking at pictures, listening to
all of it,
every kind of
life experience. You need life experience.
And you need to get, out there and fuck up a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, you do. Preferably sooner than later. But yeah, it's, you know, that's the whole thing. I probably listen to, I mean, I have a record player in my garage and I just sort of sit out there and listen to music, you know, all, in fact, this Saturday I took some shrooms and I was listening to like Os Mutantes for like over and over again. And that was really fascinating. You know, music, I think, more than anything. And I think the structure, the movies are kind of more inspired by music than anything, right? Because it's like what we always say. It's, you know, it's, well, music's been around so much longer than film, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no, you can have 800 different tonal shifts in a song.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not even thought of as a thing, right? Sampling. But in film, because it's sort of how a lot of people are taught, it's supposed to be, you're supposed to sustain a tone, right? So I am more excited by music because I feel like there are less rules, way less rules, you know?
Although we've lost like the art of the album, you know, like of an album as telling a story from 1 to right. 10 tracks or whatever it is, more about, you know, what singles on iTunes or whatever. But
well, but see, that's why I got the record player, because it forces you know, I don't know where each song is. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't listen to my favorite song. And it's what's so exciting. You have to treat the album as an album. It forces you, you know, it's not just some pretentious, like Urban Outfitters sort of cool looking decoration. You know, it's, I think it, I mean, certainly for creative types, you have to think, you know, you get lost in between songs. It's, yeah, probably music more than anything. And I did, I guess I just finished reading a book about music also. I like reading and music.
And we do love our sponsor, Urban Outfitters. We do love
shrooms are
you.
Cool.
Despite Ricky's slander.
Well, no. So that was how I pitched, certainly to Amanda Tone Dev. I said Evil Urban Outfitters. Nice. And that's sort of when I designed with my storyboard artist the poster, the drawn poster. Yeah. So I paid for that one myself. And all the color palettes are stolen from Urban Outfitters websites.
I can tell from the start. I mean, it really does have a super modern now. It felt like if I turned on any TV show right now about young people, it would look like the aesthetic of yours. But I love that then soon it's going to be in a gothic house.
Yeah.
And the bar scene's really beautifully lit. So it's not that one thing.
Well, that's yeah. – we should – you know, this guy Ed Wu was so awesome.
Your DP?
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Your first time with him?
First time.
Okay.
And
do you change that on purpose? Because I know a lot of people just stay with the same DPs or –
I've never used the same DP twice. Okay. Well, I do a thing where it's for the most part, and you know, sometimes it's not fun for DPs. I pick at every frame, you know, because because the stuff on screen is going to be so crazy. I want there to be sort of a tight knit uniformity to the filmmaking, and the filmmaking really, really matters to me. Like when I see bad filmmaking, and so I try to do the best we can, you know, in the allotted days with a lot of it. But I lost my train of thought.
You're talking about the new cinematography.
The new DP, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you know, they contribute so much because they paint with light, right? I don't fuck with their lighting.
Yeah.
I really don't. And so it's, you know, I've gone from one to the other to the other. And then Ed is just the king. You know, you know what you often get kind of a, and I'm not saying that I've experienced this, but it seems to be a personality trait of a lot of DPs or younger ones. They're just very like overly masculine bro type. You know what I mean? And it's not kind of how I make movies, you know, where it's like a carnival and we're all sort of the same. I would never sort of, you know, assert myself like that. So, you know, it's never hire a DP that has anything but DP credits. If they have one director credit, don't hire them. If they have anything else, no. DP that only wants to be a DP. That's how you do it.
I think that's that joke that, like, was a Nolan's guy he used every time. As soon as he directed his film, that's the end of that relationship. And it happens a lot because now there's some sort of power dynamic that's altered. You know?
Yeah. And I don't actually have any, like, sort of bad relationships at all with my other DPs at all. But, you know, where I'm always trying to. Sometimes it doesn't work out right schedule wise, but I'm always sort of thinking about the next look, how do we improve upon it or change it? What kind of personality would be better for this film? you know, Ed Wu, he shot Slight, which actually it's a Blumhouse thing, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a guy so talented that he doesn't have to have an ego, you know? He is just a total, like, total team player. You know, the kind of guy you can have fun with making a movie where you're bouncing ideas, you know, back and forth. Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, he came up with, you know, the acid sequence. Mm-hmm. So he came up with this cool rig.
The lighting.
We're actually manually spinning.
Yeah, no, I definitely was cool looking at that and wondering how you guys were doing that, like some sort of rotation.
Yeah, like it was crazy. You know, so much fun stuff for that guy.
It's cool.
Hire him, filmmakers, but not when I'm shooting movies because I want him.
So you would use him a second time.
I'm going to use Ed again. Mm. I'm going to use Ed until Ed doesn't want to work with me.
I really want this movie's coming out August 23rd, theaters, VOD, on demand, the whole deal. But I really want a Ricky Bates like box set, which I know is kind of impossible since they're all with different companies. But Excision's pretty readily available. I mean, I'm a physical collector, so I've seen the Blu-ray and DVD. Suburban Gothic, I just looked up. To get a Blu-ray of that, it's
I can't
like,
even afford my
it's
own
like
movie.
$70.
Yeah, oh, are you serious? Yeah.
Did they not give you copies of that? Who the hell freaking distributed
that? I got a copy when it came out, but it was still like $35, $40 for like a new release.
Who ran
weird,
the distro on that one?
Well, it was never released here. It's like a Canadian release.
It was just a digital release here, right?
Digital release here.
I'm looking it up now.
And then Trash Fire, which you know, still really bums me out because I do think I am really proud of that movie, and we never got a Blu-ray release because I guess they said Blu-rays. I don't know if this is true. I don't know. You know, I just what they said was, you know, Blu-rays are a money pit or whatever. You know, but I would have loved to have a copy of that on Blu-ray.
Is there one anywhere in the world? That's Lionsgate.
Yeah, Germany.
All right, I've got an all-region player.
God bless. You know, these Germans dig my weird shit. Yeah.
That didn't faze them at all.
Yeah.
House on fire. Whatever.
Yeah, children are probably watching my movies in Germany,
which is pretty cool. All right. Tone Deaf comes out at the end of this month. I want everybody to see it. I just want more Ricky Bates movies. Every time you come on and every time you put a new movie out, it is so you. I love when filmmakers have a very distinct voice. I mean, we were talking about Midsommar not too long ago, and it's like within 15 minutes, I was like, oh yeah, this is the guy that made Hereditary. And I can't believe they're letting him make these movies. Like, we need more of these kind of voices. Ever since Excision, ever since I stalked you on Twitter to be my friend.
Well, you know what? And now you're happy. I don't even know this fucking guy.
Can you not hang out with me anymore?
I don't feel comfortable around this smiling person. You know?
All right.
See the movie. I like it. I hope you do too. If you see it, maybe I'll get to, you know, keep doing this. So for the love of God, actually, you know what? Let me be more adamant here. Please see the fucking movie. I love doing this. I'd like to keep doing this, and I need you to see it, especially that first week, because I think that's what those people care about. I'll never see a dime of this. Okay. Not a single penny. This only helps me so much.
Yes. Rate and review.
Although if you'd like to make donations.
Ricky Bates telephone?
I will put it towards my pagan comedy.
All right. Yay. There we go.
I'm not doing that. Just, I'm going to go to sleep now.
We're just gonna
thank you, Ricky Bates, for joining us tonight.
Let's thank Maya,
Hi, Maya. She's
still here.
She
had to stay here for this whole fucking thing.
We said
Katrina,
she could leave.
Katrina made her stay for this whole thing.
No, Judy.
Oh, Judy. Judy and it. Katrina. And she's a great employee because I said you can leave and I won't tell them. I won't say a goddamn thing. You know, she's young. She's got a life to live. I said, go out, live your fucking life. She said, no, I don't want to get in trouble. You know, so this is, you've got her, you've got her wrapped around your finger.
She's got Katrina good work ethic. PR. Promote her.
She's got great work ethic and good night.
She cares about the movie.
And she cares about the movie. She cares about her fucking job.
We feel the same way about Ernie.
Understand.
Ernie,
we told Ernie he could leave, and he stayed and kept recording. So I respect that, Ernie.
I appreciate you.
Thanks, Ricky. We love you.
Yeah.
We really do.
We're glad you came. I'm glad I wrote you on Facebook.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I mean, holy cow. This is fun, man. I got to talk to some people today. For real.
Back to the dungeon. Back to the dungeon.
We will see you guys tomorrow at Midsummer Scream.
Yes. And then we will have that episode up, but we will be off for live for 2 weeks after that.
Yes.
But then we will be back.
No, we will only be off for...
Well, yeah, Midsummer will be one of the episodes.
I'm gone. Later, guys.
Right. Wait, what the hell are you talking about? Elric and I are going to do something crazy. All right. We don't know what it's going to be.
I'm going to Ricky's house.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Dude, you should.
I will.
I got a sweet record player.